Hello, I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi, and it's time for our birthdays. Margaret Holliday of Greenfield, we wish you a happy birthday today. And Les Secor of Des Moines, we hope you have a wonderful happy birthday today as well. If you share a birthday today with Margaret and Les and you didn't hear your name with theirs, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Here's a reminder that our program schedule has changed dramatically so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. Let's get back to the news by turning to USA Today. We'll begin with five things that the editors of USA Today say we need to know on this Thursday, July 30th, 2020. First, three former presidents to attend John Lewis's funeral in Atlanta. Three former presidents are expected to attend the funeral Thursday for civil rights icon John Lewis, a remarkable nod of respect from the highest level of government. Former presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton will attend. So will Barack Obama, who is expected to deliver a eulogy, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported. The service for Lewis will take place at the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church Horizon Sanctuary, marking the end of a series of events that honored Lewis in Atlanta, Washington, D.C., and Alabama. Lewis, who died July 17th after battling stage 4 pancreatic cancer, left behind a titanic legacy of civil rights and social justice activism. He was one of the organizers of the March on Washington, D.C. in 1963, along with Martin Luther King, Jr. Second, mission to Mars. NASA plans rover launched to look for signs of life. An unmanned rover will look for clues of ancient life in the dry bed of a vanished lake in NASA's upcoming Mars mission, set to launch Thursday from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida. If all goes as planned, the Mars 2020 Perseverance, along with its companion, the Ingenuity helicopter, will embark on a 6-month journey to Mars and land on Jezero Crater. The mission will mark the first time NASA attempts to fly a helicopter on Mars, the first time the space agency will have microphones on the rover to record sound on the red planet, and the first to have zoom capability on its camera. Third, GDP. We'll see Thursday just how bad the economy was in quarter two. The unprecedented collapse that the U.S. economy suffered in the second quarter will be laid bare Thursday, with a report projected to show a record 35% annualized drop in gross domestic product. As states shut down restaurants, stores, factories, and other businesses to contain the spread of the coronavirus, nearly every corner of the economy was hammered, analysts say. Gross domestic product, or GDP, represents all goods and services produced in the country. The economy's partial black slide is expected to be underscored by Thursday's report on last week's initial jobless claims, which is projected to rise by about 15,000 to 1.43 million. Fourth, fans rejoice. Basketball is back. After a 4-month hiatus, the NBA will restart its season Thursday at Disney's ESPN Wide World of Sports complex in Orlando, Florida, without any fans, one of many safety precautions the league has taken to resume operations during the coronavirus pandemic. TNT will showcase a doubleheader with the New Orleans Pelicans playing the Utah Jazz at 6:30 p.m. Eastern, followed by the Los Angeles Lakers facing the Clippers at 9 p.m. Eastern. The NBA has installed 17-foot video boards that feature 320 virtual fans and display a player's profile after a made shot. The arena also has an in-house DJ that plays music frequently throughout the game and during timeouts. Every TNT and ESPN telecast will feature up to 31 cameras, including ones that are placed courtside and below the rim. The networks will amplify their microphones to pick up sneaker squeaks, ball bounces, and on-court trash talk and strategy. And finally, the GLAAD Media Awards go virtual. After being postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the GLAAD Awards are back on schedule Thursday for an online ceremony. The annual awards highlight artists and creators for their contributions to increasing LGBTQ+ representation in Hollywood. This year, pop star Taylor Swift and Pose producer Janet Mock will be honored for their work to support the LGBTQ+ community. The media advocacy organization also announced a star-studded lineup ahead of Thursday's show, with comedians Fortune Feimster and Gina Yashir hosting the gala. Other special guests include Dolly Parton, the cast of FX's Pose, Dwayne Wade, Gabriel Union, Gigi Gorgeous, Lily Singh, and Demi Lovato. In coronavirus updates, the U.S. death toll from the coronavirus pandemic surpassed 150,000 Wednesday, with little indication the historic global health crisis is diminishing. Barely 2 months ago, the number of Americans killed by the virus was 100,000. Just last week, the U.S. surpassed 4 million infections, doubling its total case count in 6 weeks. And the nation is still averaging about 1,000 deaths and 60,000 infections per day. Not all states are on the same trajectory, of course. New York and some of the northeastern states have tamped down the surge. California, Texas, and Florida are among a raft of states now struggling mightily. Quote, as is the case with any infectious outbreak, there are different curves playing out at the same time, said Ogobanaya Omenka, an associate professor and public health specialist at Butler University. Quote, in essence, it's getting better and worse at the same time. Attorney General Barr tests negative. A day after his brief interaction with Representative Louie Gohmert, who has contracted the coronavirus, Attorney General Bill Barr tested negative Wednesday, the Justice Department reported. Barr took the test after being notified of Gohmert's positive result. Gohmert joins a growing number of lawmakers to contract the virus. The Texas Republican has previously refused to wear a mask while speaking on the House floor, and reporters on Capitol Hill have frequently spotted him without one. Gohmert said he has worn a mask more, quote, in the last week or two, end quote, and suggested he may have contracted the virus by moving it around on his face. Quote, I can't help but think if I hadn't been wearing a mask so much in the last 10 days or so, I really wonder if I wouldn't have gotten it, he said. Pelosi mandates masks on House floor. Hours after a Republican congressman who opposes face mask mandates tested positive for COVID-19, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said all members of the House of Representatives would be required to wear them on the floor. Pelosi, a Democrat from California, said lawmakers could be removed from the floor if they are not wearing a face covering. Earlier Wednesday, it was revealed Texas Representative Louie Gohmert, who usually eschews masks, has contracted the virus. Quote, the chair expects all members and staff to adhere to the requirement as a sign of respect for the health, safety, and well-being of others present in the chamber, Pelosi said, adding that a lawmaker not wearing a mask would be considered, quote, a serious breach of decorum, end quote. Chief of Staff not optimistic about deal. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows cast doubt on the possibility of a stimulus deal Wednesday, telling reporters on Capitol Hill after meetings with Democratic leaders that he's not optimistic of reaching an agreement. On Monday, Republicans unveiled a $1 billion pandemic relief package that, among other things, would decrease the current $600 a week unemployment supplement to as low as $200. In May, House Democrats proposed a plan that would extend the $600 boost through the rest of the year. Quote, we're nowhere close to a deal, Meadows said, adding, quote, it means enhanced unemployment insurance provisions will expire, end quote, on Friday. Florida deaths surpassed 200 in a day for the first time. The Florida Department of Health reported an inauspicious daily record of COVID-19 deaths for the second day in a row Wednesday. The 216 fatalities marked the first time deaths have surpassed 200 and bring the state death toll to 6,333. If the state averages 200 fatalities per day, the total death toll would more than double by Labor Day. The surge comes less than 2 weeks before some public schools begin their new school year amid pressure from state officials to provide in-class instruction. The number of new COVID-19 cases increased by 9,446 Wednesday, marking the 36th consecutive day that Florida has recorded more than 5,000 new cases. There was a modest silver lining. The state has recorded 4 state days with less than 10,000 new cases, the first time that's happened since July 6th through 9th. Doctor in video Trump retreated was sued in woman's death. A Houston doctor who has made outrageous claims and appeared on a video retweeted by Trump was sued for malpractice after a woman she treated in Louisiana died last year, the Houston Chronicle reported. In the video, Dr. Stella Emanuel touts the coronavirus-fighting virtues of hydroxychloroquine, a malaria drug Trump has repeatedly promoted, even though federal regulators last month revoked authorization of its use as an emergency treatment amid growing evidence it doesn't work and can have deadly side effects. Quote, "You don't need masks. There is a cure," Emanuel says in the video, which Twitter and Facebook took down because it spread coronavirus misinformation. Quote, "You don't need people to be locked down," end quote. Quote, "I thought she was very impressive," Trump said about Emanuel on Tuesday. Emanuel, who has said some medical conditions can be caused by having sex with demons in a dream, was sued in January. She and another doctor treated a Louisiana woman named Leslie Norvell, who said she had part of a hypodermic needle stuck in her arm, the newspaper reported, adding that Norvell died 6 days later. Pence vows support for schools to reopen. The Trump administration continued its push to have schools reopen for in-person learning during the pandemic, as Vice President Mike Pence visited a class of fourth graders at a North Carolina public school. Trump has threatened to withhold federal funds from K-12 schools that don't reopen their classrooms in the fall term, a critical component of igniting the economy by allowing parents to return to work. Quote, "We're all going to make sure schools across America have the support to open up and stay open," said Pence, who was joined at the Raleigh area campus of Thales Academy by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. The Los Angeles School District, the country's second largest, has already said all instruction in the fall will be online. So has San Diego's. Many other districts are still formulating their plans. New York's has said it will go with a hybrid approach. At the schools in the town of Alcoa, south of Knoxville, Tennessee, which are employing a hybrid, staggered schedule, one person tested positive for the coronavirus 2 days after students returned on July 22nd. Anyone who came in contact with the infected person will have to quarantine for 14 days. And increasingly, many pandemic job losses looking permanent. Everyone wants the current unemployment crisis to be temporary, but new data reveals that millions of jobless Americans may not have a role to return to once the pandemic ends. In April, 78% of those in households experiencing job loss felt that situation would be temporary. Now, almost half think that job loss is likely to be permanent, according to the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. All told, roughly 10 million workers might need to find a new employer after the pandemic wraps up, and some might need to switch gears and find a new profession altogether. In other top stories, Karen Weintraub and Ken Altucker of USA Today report FDA opens door to rapid at-home testing for COVID-19. The Food and Drug Administration on Wednesday opened the door to COVID-19 testing that could be fast, cheap, and handled entirely at home if companies don't find the rules too burdensome. Routine screening of people who don't know they have COVID-19 could transform the fight against the disease. Quote, "These types of tests will be a game changer in our fight against COVID-19 and will be crucial as the nation looks toward reopening," FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn said in a statement announcing how the agency will approve at-home tests. So far, the FDA hasn't allowed anyone to sell tests for at-home use. Lab tests to detect the coronavirus are accurate, but they're often restricted to people who have COVID-19 symptoms. It often takes days to get results, by which point the person may have already infected others. Other tests are fast, but so expensive they're unlikely to be used regularly. A clinic in Massachusetts, for example, charges $160 per rapid test. It's not covered by insurance. With COVID-19, people are most contagious in the few days before they develop symptoms and as symptoms first develop. Screening at home, maybe once or twice a week, would allow people to test themselves before going to work or school, getting on an airplane, attending an event, or visiting an elderly relative. Letting people know they are infectious in real time would enable them to self-quarantine, and it would allow others to go about day-to-day life without risk of infecting others. Will FDA rules encourage or discourage companies to create at-home tests? Several testing experts, including Dan Larimore of the University of Colorado, said the FDA's move is a step in the right direction and could encourage companies to pursue inexpensive, rapid, at-home tests. But Dr. Michael Mina, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, said the way the FDA's guidance template is written makes it less likely that such crucial tests will reach the general public. The template spells out how a sample is to be collected and analyzed and how results are to be shown to a user without the need to send a sample to a lab for analysis. The template also outlines how accurate the tests must be, with slightly lower standards than lab-based tests. Quote, "The required software alone will pose an incredibly large hurdle for many," Mina said via email. Quote, "Unfortunately, the template does not offer this type of so-called new avenue that I think is going to be necessary if we want to truly $1 daily tests become a reality," end quote. Mina said the standards should be lowered further. People are contagious only when there's an extremely high virus level in their body, which can be detected by a less sensitive test. An infection that goes undetected by a less sensitive test would be caught a few days later when the person is tested again, he said. Or the person would already be on the way to recovery and probably wouldn't be contagious. Similar rapid tests used to diagnose strep throat miss as many as 1 in 5 people who are infected, so physicians normally send a throat culture to a lab to confirm the diagnosis, said Dr. Emily Volk, president-elect of the College of American Pathologists. Such confirmatory testing usually takes several days. If that were done with COVID-19, it could add to the delays of traditional testing rather than relieve them. A race to create a cheap, fast COVID-19 test. There are several tests close to market that are fast and relatively cheap, but none meets Mina's vision. A rapid test that costs as little as $1 and can provide an answer before someone leaves the house in the morning. The XPRIZE, a nonprofit that designs and hosts public competitions, announced Tuesday it would split a $5 million prize among 5 winners who can produce a test that delivers results in as little as 15 minutes and costs less than $15. The winners will also split $50 million intended for rapid manufacturing scale-up, said Jeff Huber, president and co-founder of Open COVID Screen, whose company is launching the competition in collaboration with XPRIZE. The competition is open until the end of August. About 200 semifinalists will be selected. They'll be winnowed to 20 finalists and then 5 winners. Contenders will have to meet criteria that will speed up FDA approval. They'll get expert advice from large-scale testing companies, Huber said. The 5 winners will be ready to scale up manufacturing by the end of the year, he said. Fertility doctors develop tests for coronavirus. In another approach to innovative testing, Sorrento Therapeutics of San Diego has licensed technology developed at Columbia University in New York City. Dr. Zev Williams, director of the Columbia University Fertility Center, has spent years developing tests to help couples with genetic diseases or repeat miscarriages have healthy babies. Early in the pandemic, Williams said his team concluded that finding the genetic signature of the virus that causes COVID-19 wasn't all that different. The technology they've developed essentially looks for that genetic signature in a saliva sample. The sample is put into a container with enzymes that, when heated, turn the liquid red to indicate no virus present or yellow to show an infection. The test is as accurate as the current standard called a PCR test, which relies on expensive lab-based machines, said Henry G., Sorrento's CEO and co-founder. The company expects the test, which has not yet received FDA approval, to cost around $10, said Mark Brunswick, the company's senior vice president of regulatory affairs. Test company official, FDA has moved the goalposts. In a third approach, Intrivo Diagnostics of Santa Monica, California, and Access Bio of Somerset, New Jersey, are collaborating to design and distribute a rapid, at-home test. Dr. Michael Harbour, Chief Medical Executor, Medical Officer of Intrivo, said he expects to complete the FDA approval process in the next 90 days. Their test provides a finger-pricking device and analyzes a drop of blood. A blue line would indicate a positive for the virus. No line would be an all clear. The test should be accurate enough to meet the FDA guidelines, Harbour said. The companies are prepared to conduct trials as required by the FDA to make sure the test is easy enough for most people to use. He said he did not know how much it would cost. The FDA, Harbour said, has, quote, moved the goalposts, end quote, several times, requiring testing companies to follow one protocol, then another. But he's hopeful that it's now clear how important this type of test will be to keep the virus under control. Quote, if the FDA is smart, he said, they are going to work quickly to make these available, end quote. In breaking news, John Bacon of USA Today reports a magnitude 4.2 earthquake rattles Southern California, and it's rich and famous. At least two small tremors rocked an area near Los Angeles early Thursday, shaking residents out of their sleep but drawing no initial reports of damage or injury. A preliminary 4.2 magnitude earthquake hit the Pacoima area at about 4:30 a.m., according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Pacoima, in the northern San Fernando Valley region, is about 20 miles northwest of downtown Los Angeles. The quake was downgraded from an initial estimate of 4.5. The area was rolled by a magnitude 3.3 quake or aftershock about 10 minutes later, the USGS said. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office noted the quakes on Twitter, directing residents to its earthquake preparedness page. The rattling drew notice across social media despite the pre-dawn hour. Quote, definitely felt it in North Hollywood, one tweet said. Another, quote, yes, quite strong up here in La Crescenta, end quote. Some of the rich and famous also took note. Quote, oh man, wow, that felt much bigger than a 4.5 earthquake, tweeted Khloe Kardashian. So scary, sneakers and my flashlight by my bed, end quote. Quote, that literally just scared me, tweeted TV personality Karamo Brown. My entire house was shaking and my dogs were howling before and while it was happening. I'm awake now. 2020 is enough, end quote. Social media star Kevin Lang tweeted that, quote, the earthquake was so strong I woke up and my bed was in the yard, end quote. In world news, Joshua Boat of USA Today reports researchers have discovered the origins of Stonehenge's massive, mysterious sarsen stones. The giant boulders that comprise Stonehenge have provided a sense of wonder for visitors and academics who come to visit the prehistoric monument. Now, after centuries of debate by archaeologists, the origin of the large sarsen stones, also known as megaliths, have been traced just 15 miles away from the monument itself, near the town of Marlborough. The breakthrough was published in the Science Advances Journal Wednesday. Stonehenge is built out of two types of stones, sarsen stones, which all 15 of the monument's central horseshoe are made out of, and smaller bluestones, which have been traced to the Pressley Hills in Wales, per English Heritage. The megaliths, each weighing tons of thousands of pounds and standing up to 22 feet, have never been tested. But a restoration of Stonehenge more than 60 years ago required three stones in the monument to be re-erected. In order to ensure the integrity of one of the megaliths, which had a fracture through it, three horizontal holes were drilled. The core material from these drillings were thought to be vanished until last year, when a man named Robert Phillips, who was present at the repairs, returned one of the cores to English Heritage. Phillips, who now lives in Florida, wanted it sent back on the day before his 90th birthday. After performing non-destructive tests on the sarsens at Stonehenge, researchers were able to determine that they all came from the same area. They then analyzed different sarsen formations or outcrops across England. Quote, each outcrop was found to have a different geochemical structure, but it was the chance to test the returned core that enabled us to determine the source area for the Stonehenge star sarsens, said David Nash, a professor of geography at Brighton University. After performing a destructive test on the returned core, they traced it back to an area known as the West Woods. These stones, English Heritage historian Susan Greeney said in a statement, were likely chosen because builders, quote, wanted the biggest, most substantial stones they could find, and it made sense to get them from as nearby as possible, end quote. Scientists have yet to figure out the route and method they used to transport these gargantuan stones to their current location. To complicate the mystery, two stones were obtained elsewhere per the study published Wednesday. Still, this key discovery helps make sense out of this ancient mystery. Quote, to be able to pinpoint the area that Stonehenge's builders used to source their materials around 2500 BC is a real thrill. Now we can start to understand the route they might have traveled and add another piece to the puzzle, Greeny said. And in crime news that has made national headlines, Emma Dale of the Detroit Free Press reports in USA Today, mystery deepens in death of Susie Zhao, a professional poker player found burned in Michigan. A poker player, a traveler, someone described as bubbly, playful, and tough. Someone who seemed to never show her hand, even outside of the gambling world. That's how friends describe Susie Zhao, age 33, the woman whose body was found badly burned on the early morning of July 13th in the Pontiac Lake Recreation Area in White Lake Township, Michigan. Authorities believe she was killed at the recreation area, then her body was set ablaze, although her cause of death has not yet been released. The case has left friends and colleagues in shock. Quote, she did not let on if there were any problems in her life, said longtime friend Meredith Rogowski, age 32. That was common. She was very good at concealing anything, concealing her hand, as you'd say, end quote. Zhao was a professional poker player with earnings over a span of 11 years totaling $152,852, according to her World Series of Poker player profile. She recently moved back into her parents' home in Michigan after living in Las Vegas and California for a decade. Rogowski grew up with Zhao. They became friends in sixth grade when they rode the same bus to school, and then they'd walk home from the bus stop together. After graduation, Zhao went to Northwestern University on a scholarship to study mathematics, but ended up switching to psychology. But her real love was poker, Rogowski said. While her friends in high school were working minimum wage jobs, Rogowski said Zhao took her high school graduation money and doubled it at a Michigan casino. Quote, throughout college, she played online poker. She would sit at a computer for 8 hours and play online poker, Rogowski said. She would play multiple games at once. It was not unexpected that she chose that career. We were happy for her, end quote. Bryce Yockey, age 32, of Los Angeles, met Zhao around 2012 through their circle of poker friends. Throughout the next few years, he said he formed a tight-knit friendship with Zhao and traveled with her. Quote, she was fun, silly, and quirky, he said, very intelligent, kind, and good-hearted. She liked to play games. She was creative and always had a side project that she was working on. She was kind of like one of the boys, end quote. Yockey said that when he heard of his friend's death, he was in disbelief. Quote, her death feels so random and senseless in a way, Yockey said. This is so out of left field. What happened? End quote. Reports have speculated that Zhao's death could be related to her involvement in the poker world. Yockey said she wasn't the type of person who didn't pay her debts or who would leave somewhere to avoid it. White Lake Township Police Detective Lieutenant Christopher Hild said police have not been able to connect anything that ties her career to her death. Quote, we're looking at every avenue, whether it was part of her hitchhiking. She used to hitchhike quite a bit. She got rides with people she didn't know frequently, Hild said. So did she run into the wrong person, or does this have something to do with her history that nobody is aware of? That's what we're digging into right now. Rogowski said her friend didn't let on about her reasons for moving back to the area. All Zhao would say is that she was pursuing new opportunities in poker, such as coaching and commentating. Quote, she was really vague, she said. Hearing that she may have had personal problems going on was a surprise to me, because she always presented her situation as if nothing was going on. I had no reason to think otherwise, end quote. But Zhao's new journey in Michigan wouldn't last long, said her mother, with her mother seeing her for the last time at about 5:30 p.m. Sunday, July 12th, Hild said. Zhao had returned from a trip to see friends earlier in the day. When her parents returned that evening at about 10:30 p.m., Zhao was nowhere to be found. Hild said Zhao's vehicle recently was impounded by the police department prior to her death for traffic-related offenses. Police are looking into whether Zhao was picked up that evening and talking to neighbors about what they saw. The recreation area where Zhao's body was found was last checked by a Department of Natural Resources officer at 11:45 p.m., on July 12th, Hild said. At that time, Zhao was nowhere in sight, which makes police believe she was killed sometime between then and the next morning around 8 when her body was found. Hild said Zhao was wearing jogging pants, tennis shoes, and a jogging-type top when her body was found. The medical examiner had preliminary results on the cause of death, but Hild said is waiting to release it pending other toxicology reports. The White Lake Township Police Department is investigating with FBI assistance. Quote, we're just heartbroken, heartbroken for her mother. Her friends are trying to do anything we can to support her family right now, Rogowski said. Quote, to me, looking for a reason for what happened is sort of useless because obviously anyone who would do something like that is not in their right mind, end quote. Anyone who has information on Zhao's whereabouts prior to her death may contact Hild at 248-698-4404, extension 2381. Let's turn now to the opinion section of today's Des Moines Register. At the top of the page is Rekha Basu's column, titled, As Iowa is Shunned, Reynolds Digs Her Heels In. Another week, another rejection. Now, neighboring Illinois doesn't want anything to do with us. Its governor is asking residents of his state to avoid Iowa because lately our rate of positive COVID-19 tests is a whopping 7.2%, compared with Illinois' 3.7%. That disc comes after East Coast states insisted Iowans quarantine on arrival there. So did the city of Chicago. Are we embarrassed to be pariahs as much larger, more diverse, and congested states got their COVID numbers down through stricter measures? Is our leader ready to admit she was wrong, first for not mandating sheltering in place, and then for relaxing social distancing as numbers were still rising? Not a bit. As 30 of 50 states require face coverings, Governor Kim Reynolds digs her heels in. The upshot is that Dubuque and Scott counties are facing their highest COVID numbers yet. What's more, the median age of those testing positive has fallen to below 30 years old. And some shopkeepers are regretting having eased up restrictions. Even urging this week by the Iowa Medical Society and 14 other groups representing thousands of health professionals to require masks in public has fallen on deaf ears. As of Tuesday, Iowa had 843 COVID-19 deaths. Hospitalizations have more than doubled since June after a decline. Reynolds' spokesman said the governor doesn't believe in a government mandate, nor will she let city's leaders issue them. And now she's insisting, with no blueprint for doing it safely, that Iowa schools reopen at least 50% in person. Maybe one of the worst results of political leadership's failure to take stricter action is that it has fed the beliefs of those who distrust science and see political conspiracies in mandates. According to a New York Times Siena College poll, 84% of voters trust medical science on the virus. That's 90% of Democrats and 75% of Republicans. So it's hard to see reasonably educated-looking people out mingling with no protection. My family and I were shocked over the weekend to visit a metro-area beer hall renowned for its large patio space and find none of the patrons inside masked. Also, an older Madison County man, who writes often to disparage my views, emailed me after taking what he described as a wonderful 2-week car trip with his wife through parts of Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Quote, we saw lots of happy people working like normal, he wrote. Everywhere we went, I asked as many people as possible, how many people have you personally known who have had COVID-19? 100% answered, no one, end quote. They stayed at top-notch hotels for a song and had some of the finest restaurants, mostly to themselves because, quote, the press had scared travelers away, he said. I'm withholding his name because of what comes next. He feared his stance would make him a target. He believes COVID, quote, is a delusion meant to distract us from our economic collapse and a myth perpetrated by the government and the press. No one dies from the virus, he insists. And, citing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization, he said asymptomatic people rarely infect anyone. The trick is just to, quote, stay away from bedridden and coughing people, end quote. His other solution? Quote, a temperature check at the front door and every business and school in the country could open tomorrow, end quote. Early on, WHO wrongly denied asymptomatic transmission and said masks weren't necessary. The CDC says recent studies indicate that people who are infected but don't have symptoms are likely to contribute to its spread. New research from Korea also shows COVID can be spread as widely by children between 10 and 19 as by adults. As for temperature checking, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute of Health says that that and other screenings can get it wrong and are no replacement for other protective measures such as social distancing. But is it any wonder that people don't believe the science when the U.S. president shows outright disdain for the CDC by trying to cut its budget and ordering hospitals to bypass sending information to it? Why would an Iowan take the risk seriously when our governor tiptoes around the topic, not wanting to scare anyone or be too much at odds with the president? Maybe we should have been scaring more people sooner and reasoning with them like adults. For now, I'm sticking with the Iowa Medical Society, the CDC, and Fauci. Again, that was Rekha Basu's column in today's Des Moines Register. In letters to the editor, Nathan Erickson of Ames writes, Congress can and should safeguard the outdoors. In June, the Senate voted to pass the Great American Outdoors Act, and the House followed suit this month, securing funding for the Land and Water Conservation Fund and providing an opportunity to carry out maintenance that has been deferred on our outdoor spaces. Also, it is encouraging that many of our federal representatives from Iowa voted to pass it. A vote in favor of America's national parks is one of the easiest environmental issues to stand in favor of because there is almost no difficulty in protecting our parks beyond the relatively small monetary cost to maintain them. The Great American Outdoors Act is the starting point to a solution we need to ensure that our parks are defended for years to come. However, the battle is not yet won. This bill was a popular one because of how little it cost. So I'd like to thank Representative Sidney Axne and our senators for supporting this bill in Congress and encourage them to continue pushing for legislation to fight climate change and protect our environment. There's still a long fight to come if we're to save our planet. Signed, Nathan Erickson of Ames. Elise Moll of Ames writes, Children aren't lab rats. Governor Kim Reynolds has usurped the local control of the public schools in the decision-making process to reopen schools in the fall. She initially requested each district develop 3 plans. As schools were announcing their plans, Reynolds changed the rules and required that students be served within their school buildings at least 50% of the time. Is Reynolds attempting to curry favor with the president rather than protect the teachers, staff, and students? I resent my daughter and my niece and their students being put at risk because Donald Trump, Betsy DeVos, and our governor may think it is acceptable. Shame on all of them. Undermining local districts by mandating an impossible task and an immoral one is poor leadership. This also demonstrates a lack of ethics from the top down. Ultimately, I think about the emotional damage to the students and the teachers who worry about a child or teacher who contracts COVID-19 and may struggle or die. This is a real issue. Our children are not a science experiment. Signed, Elise Moll of Ames. Roger Hamelman of Urbandale writes, Overpaid university employees should not complain. I have one big question. Why are Iowa's 3 public universities complaining about receiving less revenue for the following year? Has anyone associated with the 3 universities reviewed the salary metric recently? Salaries are completely out of this world. No employee, including coaches, is worth $1 million or more dollars a year in salary. An example is the situation where the University of Iowa's provost is reassigned due to settlement agreement. Why is that individual going to be employed until June 30, 2021, at a salary of $439,000 a year? That amounts to $36,583 a month. That amount is what some workers receive in a year. The public does not want to be reminded of budget problems when there is constant waste of money every year. Maybe the public needs to request a review of the state university employees' salaries. Signed, Roger Hamelman of Urbandale. Today's opinion page in the Register also includes a guest column written by Joe Murphy, who is the executive director of the Iowa Business Council. His column is titled, Working Together to Safely Reopen Our Schools. The Iowa Business Council recognizes the enormous commitment to student achievement, health, and safety that has been exhibited by teachers, school administrators, and districts across the state as schools prepare for the 2020-21 academic year. The Business Council reaffirms its dedication and commitment to K-12 institutions and the need for students to safely and physically return to school. In-person learning is critical to students' social and academic development, as cited by numerous experts, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Academy of Pediatrics. Without a return to in-person learning and the safeguards and services our educational institutions provide, disparities among educational achievement will widen and opportunities will be lost for an entire generation of Iowa school children. Our state has and will continue to benefit from the deep commitment of our business and educational leaders to prepare our younger population for successful careers right here in Iowa. It is this same commitment we must now use to work together to meet the challenge for a successful return to school. Educating our K-12 student population is an absolutely essential service. Iowans have the ability, pragmatism, and deference to make in-person learning work safely for teachers, parents, and most importantly, the students. Let's embrace this challenge by employing science, accommodating individual health needs, using technology, and being civil and respectful in the process. The Iowa Business Council further recognizes the importance of flexibility for school districts to make real-time decisions as new information emerges. In consultation with public health officials, school districts should be afforded the ability to tailor their approaches based on conditions within their communities. We should also employ evidence-based strategies to lower the risk and stop the spread of the virus in schools. Guidance on facial coverings, physical distancing, hand sanitizing stations, and other science-based strategies should be adopted to keep all involved healthy and safe. The Council further recognizes the countless examples from across Iowa of the parents and guardians balancing their work life with childcare and educating their children at home. Simply put, if students are not able to return to school, parents and guardians cannot fully return to work, and our economy will continue to suffer. Never before has Iowa's economic health been so intricately tied to the health and well-being of Iowa's population. We can all make a difference in stopping the spread of COVID-19. The Iowa Business Council strongly urges Iowans to wear facial coverings, be physically distant, and avoid crowded areas where social distancing is not possible. It is our collective responsibility in schools, at home, and in public settings to take ownership of the safety precautions to reduce the transmission of the virus. Working together, we can overcome this or any other challenge and work toward a healthy and vibrant Iowa. Again, this guest column was written by Joe Murphy, the Executive Director of the Iowa Business Council. In this role, he leads an organization comprised of CEOs and top executives from the 22 largest employers in Iowa. Let's turn now to the opinion section of USA Today, which includes a column written by Cindy L. Otis, a disinformation expert and former CIA analyst. Her column is titled, How to Spot Fake News. In early 2017, I watched from my desk at the CIA as the world learned Russia had waged an influence campaign targeting the U.S. presidential election months before. I was an intelligence analyst working in a world where countries often used covert action against each other to influence events, outcomes, and policies, but the scale and scope of Russia's actions to try to help Donald Trump get elected were unprecedented. As the intelligence community's declassified assessment stated, Russia's interference was, quote, a significant escalation, end quote, in its long-running effort to undermine America. Since then, I have seen this revelation lead to panic, but essentially no government action. The panic has manifested in a growing distrust of institutions like the news media that we traditionally counted on for information, fear that social media conversations are orchestrated by so-called Russian bots, the mainstreaming of conspiracy theories, and in extreme cases, people giving up on the existence of facts and truth altogether. But none of these problems will solve our information problem. As I write in my new book, True or False, a CIA Analyst's Guide to Spotting Fake News, I was trained to comb through massive amounts of information and root out fact from fiction to keep policymakers informed. The techniques included investigating information sources, checking my own emotions, examining my personal biases, and researching information before jumping to conclusions. When I left federal service in mid-2017 to hunt disinformation from the private sector, I realized this kind of critical thinking was what people needed to employ against their own information streams. With a global pandemic and worldwide protests against police violence, we are living in a time so rampant with false information, rumors, and hoaxes that we disinformation experts call this period an infodemic, end quote. Emotions and stress are at an all-time high, so it is more important than ever to make sure you are not spreading false information. Based on my experience, here are some tips on how to assess a few recent examples of questionable so-called facts. First, at the start of the lockdowns in March, rumors were spreading on social media and through peer-to-peer messaging apps that the federal government was about to announce a nationwide military-enforced lockdown. When a Twitter user posted a video of a train transporting military equipment saying, quote, "Tanks have arrived in San Diego," implying it had started, the viral video went viral. In 24 hours, it had more than 2 million views. This was an actual video of a real thing taken by a real person, but the context was wrong. It's important to take the time to put aside any emotional reaction to the content and do a quick internet search for additional information. This would reveal that military equipment is transported by rail across the country regularly, including through San Diego. Also, about as regularly, people have long used videos of train transports to claim military invasions are underway to cause panic. A second example. In June, amid protests against police violence, claims spread across small towns that supposed violent protesters and members of far-left militant Antifa were on the way to riot and loot. In one such claim that went viral, a person tweeted, quote, 6,000 rioters and looters are on a bus to Notre Dame, Indiana, end quote. Investigating the source of the alleged information would have revealed that this person runs an anti-science health website and was probably not a credible source. Also, the tweet should have elicited a number of questions, such as, logistically, how would 6,000 people fit in one bus? If they were on separate buses, why was there no evidence of Indiana highways overrun with the number of buses it would take to transport that many people? And why would supposed rioters even go to a small town like that in the first place? A third example. This month, an anonymous QAnon conspiracy theorist claimed on Reddit that the furniture and home decor company Wayfair was kidnapping children and selling them to sexual predators under listings for overpriced cabinets and pillows. The claim went viral across social media platforms, and when Wayfair removed the items, it only fanned the conspiracy flames. It turned out a software glitch on the website caused these items to be listed for $10,000 or more. Beyond a healthy dose of skepticism about claims by an anonymous social media account one cannot verify, it would help to research the conspiracy theory group at the helm of this charge. It would reveal that the group regularly makes claims of child sex trafficking and charges celebrities, politicians, and companies with alleged involvement but has never found actual victims. The fact is, the vast majority of false content circulating online is from real people not knowing what they're sharing is false. This is why people must be a passive part of the solution to our information. This is why people must be a massive part of the solution to our information problem. Again, this guest column was written by Cindy L. Otis, a disinformation expert and former CIA analyst. In today's debate in the USA Today opinion section, the editorial board of USA Today writes, "Coronavirus briefings need less Donald Trump, more science." The 5 o'clock White House coronavirus briefings are back, and President Donald Trump has decided he knows just what the summer revival needs, more Trump, fewer scientists. In the earlier incarnation this spring, Trump was flanked at the briefings by the government's leading public health officials. That show was abruptly canceled after Trump mused about using potentially lethal disinfectant or ultraviolet light inside the body as treatments, and the administration pivoted to talking about economic reopening. Now, with the virus roaring back across swaths of the United States and the nation's death toll passing 150,000, the briefings are on again, ostensibly to inform a public desperate to understand a relentless pandemic. This time, Trump, who dislikes sharing the spotlight, has been conducting them as a one-man show, explaining that he's the gatekeeper for the latest coronavirus data passed along to him by experts. Quote, "They are giving me everything they know as of at this point in time," he said then last week, "and I'm giving the information to you," end quote. Yes, what could possibly go wrong? For starters, the president may be among the world's least credible sources of information about the coronavirus. 2 out of 3 Americans don't believe what Trump says about the outbreak, and with good reason. In his boundless effort to diminish a crisis that has become an existential threat to his re-election, he persists in vacuous cheerleading, spouting meaningless statistics and promoting miracle cures that are at best dubious and at worst harmful. Americans who relied on the White House as their coronavirus source of information became, as a group, those most likely to downplay the significance of the outbreak, according to a Pew Research Center analysis, and behave in a manner that tragically fuels viral spread. In the first briefing of the summer season, Trump struck a new tone, frankly acknowledging last week that the outbreak will probably, quote, get worse before it gets better, end quote. On Tuesday, however, things quickly went off the rails when the president approvingly cited a Houston doctor who, along with promoting outlandish COVID-19 theories, also links gynecological issues to dream sex with demons and witches. Even as Trump retweeted a video featuring the doctor, social media companies were rushing to pull it off their sites. There's obviously a right way to inform the public on the latest science-based findings about the virus, and do so with the imprimatur of the federal government's executive branch, but without all this nonsense. One good idea considered and abandoned during internal White House discussions was to resume the briefings but simply have them handled by experts at the Department of Health and Human Services. A coterie of scientists the public has come to know and respect, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's foremost expert on infectious diseases, Dr. Robert Redfield, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator, and Dr. Stephen Hahn, the head of the Food and Drug Administration, could do the talking and answer questions. Such expertise gets the highest trust ratings from Democrats and Republicans alike. The more Americans understand and believe in the harsh realities of this highly contagious disease, the more likely they will be to take necessary precautions, wearing masks, social distancing, washing hands, to help control it until a vaccine comes along. Again, this was the opinion column of the USA Today editorial board. Today's opinion page in USA Today also includes a column written by Tony Morrow, a member of USA Today's board of contributors who covered the Supreme Court for USA Today from 1982 until 2000. His column is titled, "Here's a Monument All Americans Can Rally Around. Let's Celebrate the Bill of Rights." Amid the turmoil over taking down Confederate monuments and others ranging from Christopher Columbus to Theodore Roosevelt, here's an idea that almost everyone can get behind. How about erecting monuments that celebrate the Bill of Rights? Yes, the Bill of Rights. 10 amendments to the Constitution, ratified in 1791, that spelled out the individual freedoms Americans have enjoyed ever since, including the freedom to protest against things like monuments, thanks to the First Amendment. A campaign to place Bill of Rights monuments in state capitals in all 50 states is already underway, albeit moving slowly. Arizona's Bill of Rights monument was built in Phoenix in 2012, and plans for an Oklahoma monument in Oklahoma City are progressing. A smaller-scale monument can be found in Montezuma, Iowa. It's the brainchild of Chris Bliss, a comic by trade who has made the Bill of Rights his side project. Comics, after all, benefit greatly from the First Amendment. His campaign began nearly two decades ago when there was controversy over monuments that celebrated the Ten Commandments, also often placed in state capitals. Bliss envisioned erecting Bill of Rights monuments as a way to, quote, comparison shop, end quote, with the Ten Commandments, he says whimsically. He also wants the monuments built near state capitals because, quote, every kid goes to state capitals, end quote, on school field trips. He estimates that 40,000 students a year have visited the Arizona Monument. As he delved into the project, Bliss found that the Bill of Rights was something of a forgotten document, rarely taught in schools. People knew about a patient's Bill of Rights or a Bill of Rights for airline passengers, but it was hard for people to grasp the abstract principles of the constitutional Bill of Rights, Bliss says, and therefore hard to turn those principles into marble or limestone. Donations and support for Bliss's Bill of Rights project have been sporadic over the years, with comedians like Louis Black and the late Dick Gregory helping out. The Bill of Rights has, quote, no pre-existing constituency, Bliss says, unlike other organized groups that can lobby successfully for building monuments. But in the aftermath of the recent protests nationwide that involve monuments and civil liberties, he hopes to jumpstart his project and hasten the building of Bill of Rights monuments nationwide. Quote, this is a very positive moment, Bliss says. Amendments, a safeguard for citizens. The relevance of the Bill of Rights to today's divisions is clear and deserves recognition. The Bill of Rights fosters freedom of expression, religion, due process, fair trials, protection against unreasonable government intrusion or excessive fines, among other important rights. The Ten Amendments are not without controversy. Interpreting the religion clauses of the First Amendment, the right to bear arms in the Second Amendment, and the so-called cruel and unusual punishment clause of the Eighth Amendment has been a contentious task for centuries. And there are parts of the Bill of Rights that are quirky, to say the least. The Third Amendment, for example, prohibits soldiers from being quartered in homes without the consent of owners. It was a big issue at the time of the founding, but not now. Opportunity to celebrate liberty. Bliss says there is no better remedy for monument controversies than to commemorate the Bill of Rights, which he calls, quote, the most powerful and successful assertion of individual rights and liberties ever written, end quote. He adds, quote, the ideas were radical at the time, but now people say, of course. There is not an exclusionary phrase in the entire document. It is time for us to rediscover our own Bill of Rights and to elevate it to the position of public prominence it richly deserves, end quote. Again, this column was written by Tony Morrow, a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors. And we'll close today with a letter to the editor of USA Today, written by Dennis Kostecki of Sausalito, California. His column is titled, Government Can't Muffle a Movement. In response to the civil unrest in Portland, Oregon, U.S. District Judge Michael Simon ruled that federal officers, often in unmarked vehicles and randomly seizing peaceful demonstrators, cannot use force against observers or journalists. In a world full of half-truths, chaos, confusion, sadness, and a complete loss of empathy, it warms the heart to know that our court system continues to uphold the First Amendment. We need a president, House, and Senate that do the same. We can still speak out on behalf of our Bill of Rights through a mask. Our voices may be muffled, but no tyranny or president can dim the bright light of liberty. These are perilous times. The American people must rise up in defense of our Constitution, founding principles, way of life, and future ambitions. I promise you, we will get through this, but we must not lose ourselves along the way. Barrington, Illinois, mass protests originating from the police killing of an unarmed black man are sweeping the world. Centuries of white privilege are in the spotlight, with many choosing to simply sweep the ugly problem under the carpet. There are those who refuse to even talk about it. Narrowing the wealth gap between white people and African Americans appears to be unimportant to a disturbing number of Americans. This cannot continue unabated. For any change to occur, it is ultimately people deciding they have the power to do so. This is not a feudal system where a handful of people make all the decisions. The government should take the point of view of the public and not the other way around. And that was written by Dennis Kostecki of Sausalito, California. And that's it for our second hour of the Register on IRIS. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.